If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
A storm of spoilers. Pop culture podcast established 2014. The name itself is somewhat misleading, as the podcast doesn't trade solely in spoilers, but was named as a pun on the third book in the Song of Ice and Fire series by George R.R. Martin, A Storm of Swords. It is hosted by Dave Gonzalez, a proportionately small, partially Mexican man who rarely leaves his habitat during daylight or nighttime hours. Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
A writer and critic with many accents and purple hair, which is said to signify her preternatural ability to unwillingly draw the ire of people with natural hair colors. And Neil Miller, a man with a beard, publisher of Film School Rejects, One Perfect Shot, and also notable for his ability to silently eat hard-shelled tacos, which he's doing right now, right over there.
Hey.
Together, they take on different pop culture topics each week, while Game of Thrones isn't on television. This is that podcast.
Hello and welcome to A Storm of Spoilers. You have caught us for our Wes Andersode. It is an episode about the oeuvre of Wes Anderson. Every time we get to do one of these episodes that's based on a filmmaker, I get to say oeuvre. So that's basically the reason that we're doing it. But since you already know who we are, we get to jump directly into reviews with Joanna.
Oh, oh, remember all those things I'm supposed to be ready for. Oh, man.
all this work. I was actually about to say that this is a carefully curated episode, but that is already out the window.
Oh, it's yeah, like super
it's not meticulously
chaos.
Crafted or handmade in any way.
Wes Anderson would never.
Yeah, he would be so mad at us right now.
So,
be like, guys, you only held it together for 30 seconds.
Listen, I got the countdown right. That's not something our listeners know, but it's true.
This is the part. This is the part of the Wes Anderson movie where Joanna would turn and just run away.
Run away. All right, I'm ready. Oh, okay, we got a whole bunch. This is great. Thank you guys for listening to me whine. This one comes from DWitch79, 5 stars. The title of its review is "I Have Not Fallen Down in 2018." The body of the review is "See Title of the Review, Dan." So thanks, Dan, for that review.
Excellent whip pan, Dan.
Yeah. Oh wow. Neil is freshly off that.
We've done a lot. I've done a lot of research in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, the 10 minutes or so. All right, and this one also has to do with falling down. This comes from Ian from Boston. He says, "Don't fall down on this podcast. Listen ASAP. 5 stars. Despite the fact that I'm out on hashtag don't fall down, with a dislocated knee no less, I still have this excellent podcast to keep me company. The best place to get all your Game of Thrones news, spoilers, and crackpot theories, and now the long, cold Game of Thrones-less winter. We even have the off-season tour to keep us all warm and fresh. All warm with fresh, piping hot spoilers straight from the ovens. This metaphor may have gotten away from me. Seriously, though, love the cast, love the content. Keep up the good work." Ooh, and this last one comes from LL702. "Come for the Game of Thrones, stay for the fun." 5 stars. Yes, these lovely folks review and discuss Game of Thrones and do a kick butt job at it, but they also have the fabulous off-season tour. Oh, sorry, the fabulous off season tour, where they tackle all matter of fun TV/movie topics, and they are hilarious. The hosts have great chemistry, don't talk over each other, and don't make it awkward when they disagree. They present thoughtful points as fun discussions and are guaranteed to put a smile on your face while doing so. Lord knows we need more smiles these days, and this is why I'm reading this review for this part right here, where LL702 says, "And Neil, hey, how you doing?" Winky face.
I thought it was interesting that this segment started off as a sort of impromptu "Don't Fall Down" memoriam.
Yeah.
And then it got a little weird, but I'm here for it.
I don't think it's weird, LL702. Neil is constantly broadcasting that he is on the lookout, and you were just merely responding to that call. So LL702, don't feel awkward. Feel great.
All right. That's fair. That's a good point.
Yeah. That's a good metaphor for our podcast in 2018, too. It started about being not falling down and then got weird as time went on.
Yep.
It's going to be sweet.
It's only going to get weirder from here.
That's right. Before we jump into Wes Anderson-ness, we have Neil's segment where he catches us up on things that we've already talked about because, you know, we've talked about a lot of stuff.
Yep. We got some stuff to talk about first. A reminder that Cotton of Thrones is now less than 60 days away. Also, we have found that the hotel of Con of Thrones is very near the grassy knoll, which is where I believe Dave and I will be holding the, I want to say, handily rejected great debate.
Which religion is right? Which religion is right?
Now that it's out there, I think we have to do it. that is not going to be one of the great debates, although we are planning some really awesome great debates. We'll tell you about the real ones later. This one that we're going to be holding on the grassy knoll is fake. Moving on.
Yes, please don't do any research for which religion is right. I would feel very bad.
Right. It's too broad, I think, was the criticism. Also includes religion. Not
and right. Two subjects that shouldn't necessarily be mixed up in certain conversations.
Yeah. I think, you know, next year, if we get to do it again at Con of Thrones, after Game of Thrones is over, we can do which religion was right. And that'll be...
Yes, there we go.
Okay. Anyway, a couple of things spotted on the set of Game of Thrones that we're just going to do.
Zoroastrianism. Sorry, took me a second.
Pastafarianism.
I'm just going to do a quick walk and talk, explaining a large plan, as Wes Anderson would like, but we're going to talk about a few things that were seen on set of Game of Thrones. These are probably not spoilers in the sense that it's going to be a surprise, but there were people who saw Jaime and Brienne fighting together, not fighting each other as far as I know, fighting alongside each other against a cold, dead army. It's going to be a big deal.
It's going to be like the Red Room in The Last Jedi. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
And also, among the army of the dead has been spied characters on horseback with ponytails. This means that potentially Daenerys is going to lose some of her best friends, former raper and pillager turned totally cool bros, the Dothraki. I think that it's safe to say that some people are going to be turned into whites before this is all said and done. Unsullied, Dothraki,
turned totally, turned totally cool bros. Rapers and pillagers turned totally cool bros. Yeah, Rocky story.
Everything's cool now. We don't even have to think about what happened in season one. And before I end my segment, a quick reminder that this episode is tangentially brought to you by Stitcher's Wolverine. It's Marvel's first podcast. Make sure you go to Stitcher.com/premium. Use the promo code SPOILERS. Get a free month of Stitcher Premium so that you can listen to Richard Armitage, who is in all kinds of stuff.
Including the Hobbit movies.
What? We talked about this before.
We did, but we only talked about one Hobbit movie, and there's actually three Hobbit movies.
How dare they? There's only one small book. Why would they make three movies? That's insane. You're crazy.
Crazy. So it's called Wolverine the Long Night. It is a 10-episode story. It is very engrossing. I have been listening to it. It is great. You should check it out. Also helps you support this very podcast, which is not about anything Marvel this week. Or...
Are they?
Or is it?
You guys, I made that joke without even remembering it's from Rushmore because I do it all the time. Yes, nailed it.
All right, end of my explaining the large plan.
Guys, I'm going to make that joke so many more times in this episode.
There's so many Wes Anderson throwbacks in this upcoming Wes Anderson episode. All right, this week we're going to look at all the films of Wes Anderson. There are a bunch of them, and we didn't want to just go through and review all of them because that would be boring. What we're instead going to do is talk about Wes Anderson grab bag of our favorites and some listener comments we got. And then we're going to, in the second half of the podcast, talk about Wes Anderson's newest stop-motion animated movie, Isle of Dogs, which is out now in most places, but not all places. So that will technically be a storm of spoilers if you want to check out after that. But no need to worry. We've got Wes Anderson time coming up right now. Let's start with the easiest question, or what should be the easiest question to get a barometer of where we all fall on the Wes Anderson spectrum. What is your favorite Wes Anderson film? Let's start with Neil Miller.
I am going to immediately break the rules.
No!
Film singular.
What? Way to pull a Joanna, my God.
It's really a two, it's a tie for me. Because it's a tie between his live action work and his animated work. My favorite Wes Anderson animated film out of the two is Fantastic Mr. Fox. I think that's probably my favorite Wes Anderson film. But I also have a deep well of adoration for The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. So those are my two jams. If I were to... And actually, I think Fantastic Mr. Fox is... And it's not just my favorite Wes Anderson film. It's one of my favorite like comfort food films. You know, like when you're feeling just sort of blah... Or like life gets you down, or like you turn on the news for 20 minutes, and you just want to kind of feel some joy and quirk in your life. Fantastic Mr. Fox is my go-to film.
But the cuss.
Yep.
Joanna, what's your favorite Wes Anderson film?
Oh, I'm as insufferable as a Wes Anderson film. I love Wes Anderson, so but some people find him insufferable, which we will get to. We had, I want to say just like off the top, we had basically this episode was inspired by a listener request. And then also we got an email that I think the subject line was like, no, Wes Anderson. So listen, we're going to cover both of those feelings in this entire episode. But what I was going to say is I was talking to friend of the pod, David Ehrlich, last night when I did a surprise cameo on Fighting in the War Room. And we had a little off the record conversation about Wes Anderson, because David, I don't think anyone loves Wes Anderson as much as David Ehrlich loves Wes Anderson. And he said that there are two people in the world, those who think the first half of Wes Anderson's filmography is his best and those who think the back half of his filmography is the best. Clearly, David has never read the email titled "No Wes Anderson," which is like no half of his filmography is the best. But I break that rule, which is that my favorite Wes Anderson movie comes in the first half of his filmography, but I think his back half is stronger. Like from I think it's Fantastic Mr. Fox on. I think like it's just solid. But my favorite is The Royal Tenenbaums, which is the basic bitch answer. But I'm here for your basics bitch Wes Anderson takes. So Royal Tenenbaums.
Who? That was a long way around to Royal Tenenbaums, which is good because that one was up there for mine, but not my choice. I'm going to pick Grand Budapest Hotel, which is my sort of comfort food, and it's just the world building within it. I don't think leans on any sort of preconceptions about either society or cultures or what have you. And even though that still also goes for Fantastic Mr. Fox, in the end, I find the Grand Budapest Hotel much more charming to see it acted out by that cast. So that's a nice sprinkling of favorite Wes Anderson films and Neil who cheated and therefore gets to completely disqualified. All right, this one... From a listener, it's a prompt. Confess to the podcast listeners, which dysfunctional Wes Anderson character are you the most like? I don't think that I've ever been accomplished enough to be a Wes Anderson sad man, so I'm going to have to take a side character and pick Ash from Fantastic Mr. Fox, because I have cut holes in clothing to make masks.
Excellent. Can I go? I am going to go and claim Zero, aka the Lobby Boy from Grand Budapest Hotel. Just because, like, I think for a lot of my life, I was like, I don't really know if I belong here, but I'm eager to learn. And then maybe, like, later in life, sort of ascend to some unexpected authority. But for most of my life, I was hapless as Zero, the Lobby Boy. So there you go.
Interesting. I think I also have two answers for this one.
God.
Jesus.
I think in most of my life, I've been a very Sam Shukusky type of character. This sort of eternal optimist who's also lives under a cloud of ennui. But I feel like I like J.G. Joplin, Willem Dafoe's character in the Grand Budapest Hotel. We have similar feelings about cats. We're both silently judgmental and very unpredictable. So I honestly think that's probably my character.
I love your cutaway the best, where it's just you're dramatically lit, like from the bottom, and your eyes are wide, but don't say anything.
Yeah.
And Neil's here.
We should say that that prompt came from a listener, Annette Moneri. Let's say her last name is, and she was the one who initially was like, will you please do a Wes Anderson episode? So we have a few little prompts from Annette because she got very excited when we took her up on her idea. So there you go.
Yeah.
And let this be a lesson to you that if you provide a format, we are like five times more likely to do the episode you request.
Yeah, it's less
absolutely
prep time.
Seriously, like, I don't think listeners understand how easy it is for them to get us to just, like, talk about whatever they want us to talk about, so.
Everyone's tweeting, like, watch 120 episodes of this, and it's like, well, maybe send an email with talking points, and we'll watch 120 episodes of that.
No, or maybe suggest don't. We talk about, like, maybe suggest we talk about eight films that we've all already seen.
Yeah.
Instead of watch 120 episodes of a show you've never seen, so. Yeah. Just saying.
Yep. That's all true.
All right, this one, I don't know if I have an answer right off the top of my head, so I'm definitely not going to go first, but the prompt is the best use of music in a Wes Anderson film. It's tough.
How do you even do that? How do you even determine that? I mean, there's the end sequence. Wait, is it the end sequence in Fantastic Mr. Fox?
Where they're dancing in the supermarket?
Where they're dancing. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. I have an answer for this.
Okay.
Go ahead, because I think I have another answer, but it's coming to me.
I feel bad for looping. I mean, the reason I included this, and this was a prompt for me, is that, like, Wes Anderson gets a lot of credit for being such a visual storyteller, and he is, but, like, his soundtracks are also incredible. And, I mean, depending on your taste. Maybe you don't like, you know, 70s rock music or twee whatever, but or French songs. I do. So I'm here. There's a playlist on Spotify that's like all the Wes Anderson soundtracks ever, and I listen to it a lot. And even at SF San Francisco Sketch Fest this year, back in January, I went to a live concert of the Royal Tenenbaum soundtrack, where like all these musicians, there was like, oh God, there had to be in like 30 of them, took turns just going through the whole soundtrack of Royal Tenenbaums, which I think is his best soundtrack. And I know I already picked it as my favorite film, but I think it's his best soundtrack. And the musical moment for Wes Anderson film that works the best for me is the use of Nico's These Days, which is when Gwyneth Paltrow gets off the Green Line bus and Luke Wilson's waiting for her, and there's like the reel slows down and her hair is blowing and that song kicks in. And Nico, I had never heard Nico before I saw Royal Tenenbaum. Such an interesting singer. He uses her twice in that soundtrack, and I just really, really love that. So that's mine.
That's really good. I mean, yeah, it's hard to argue with Royal Tenenbaums not having the best, like, soundtrack. But I'm going to go, just to throw things a curveball in, You Wrote a Bad Song, PD song from Fantastic Mr. Fox. that's all bluesgrassy and great, but Petey just wrote a bad song.
Yeah.
That's a musical moment.
Sure. What? There's also
Zippy Zee, Zappy Zah, Yappy Yo, Goggle Gum.
There's also
I did Google that.
There's also the liberal use of the Kinks in the Darjeeling Limited, which is one of, I think everyone agrees, one of his weaker installments. But like I rewatched the Darjeeling Limited this week, and like it's one of his weaker films. It's one of his like when we get to some like problematic Wes Anderson conversations, it's definitely one to talk about. But as a music video, it's maybe my favorite. A slow-mo of Owen Wilson, Adrian Brody, and Jason Schwartzman trying to catch a train as the Kinks play is pretty fantastic. So that's another option, possibly.
Hmm. I would like to stump for The Life Aquatic in two different ways. One.
Whoa. Yeah, exactly. Save George. Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Save George doing all the Bowie songs is delightful throughout that movie. But it really is, to me, one of the best... When I think of the best use of music, I think of like the best sort of emotional payoff combined with music, and it really is that scene at the end of Life Aquatic where the Sigur Rós song plays as they're like looking at the tiger shark. I think that that's probably one of his more beautiful cinematic moments, and it's because it sort of pays off the entire film, and the music is great, and it's just that to me is sort of like the sort of punch that you need to make it really great. It's that, like I was thinking about all the Fantastic Mr. Fox songs that I like but it's all like they're, you know, it feels like it's the running songs. It's songs that play while people are running. But this one, it felt very different, than every other song, at least in Life Aquatic. So I'm a big fan of that whole sequence at the end.
The last thing I'll mention, is the use of music in Moonrise Kingdom, because you've got the Benjamin Britten orchestral stuff that happens like in the beginning and then sort of all throughout. And then you have the Le Temps de l'Amour, which is the song that plays as they're like dancing on the shoreside by Francois Hardy. That's also really good. I really am a sucker for like French pop. So Wes Anderson really like does it for me, but I get why he doesn't do it for everyone in terms of, but if he wanted to like write the sound, if I had to pick one filmmaker to do a soundtrack for my life, I would pick Wes Anderson, personally. So. Yep.
Mm.
That wasn't
a
question.
That's like a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Good. Because I don't have an answer for that, but I do have an answer for our next prop, which is the best meticulous shot of stuff, which is broad. But if you have seen more than one Wes Anderson movie, you something's come to mind. I'm gonna pick one from Isle of Dogs, which is to say that we see. Which is to say, I skipped over the spoiler warning. I don't think this is a spoiler, which is to say that we see a bento box being prepared.
Oh, it's so good. Yes.
Watching that being done in stop motion and it not only being food, but some of the food being still alive when it's being prepared. And then the way that it's all assembled just so is like so Wes Anderson to me.
That was maybe my favorite part of that movie, to be honest with you. And that's not even a knock on the movie. I just really, really liked that sequence. Mine is going to be... So I recently... this week I rewatched Bottle Rocket, which I hadn't seen in a really long time, which is like... It's so fun to watch that movie because even though that movie's not that great, I don't think that movie's that great. It's the only Wes Anderson movie that like he didn't have such like a firm grip on his style yet. So, you know, it's got some Wilson brothers in it and it's got, you know, some themes that he likes, but it's not like, oh, Wes Anderson film yet. But that comes in Rushmore, his second film. And so I'm going to give it to Rushmore, which is like the overhead shots of basically Max's activities, specifically the Stamp and Coin Club shot, vice president of the Stamp and Coin Club. So that to me, like the overhead shot of stuff, which this was another one of my prompts. The overhead shot of stuff is such a like defining Wes Anderson thing, and you get that really hardcore for the first time in Rushmore. So that's my vote. Neil.
Yes. Hi. Still here.
The stuff shot, the ephemera.
Stuff shot. Okay, so this was a tough one for me because I enjoy all of Wes Anderson's overhead shots, and I keep coming back to the ones that are people or animals, like the shot of, like, in Fantastic Mr. Fox, down the manhole. I think there's a couple of them. So I'm going to combine the two ideas, and it's the Grand Budapest Hotel shot where Saoirse Ronan, see, said it right. Got
you
it.
You did. You nailed
time.
It. Nailed it, buddy.
And Tony Revolori's character are in the room full of cookie boxes, or not cookie boxes, they're macaroons, right?
Pastry boxes.
In the pastry boxes, and they look up through the hole out the roof that has been torn. So it is both an overhead shot of stuff and an overhead shot of characters and an overhead shot full of whimsy.
That's certainly whimsy.
Personal musical. Favorite of mine.
I want to say that, the pastry in Grand Budapest Hotel is called the Courtesan au Chocolat. Just, you know, just so we don't get any, like, haughty pastry correction emails.
You guys talked about the movie, but you didn't have the pastry name correct. Actually, that's totally an email we'd get. I shouldn't even make fun of that.
It's more like a tweet we would get, and that's okay, because we like to be accurate, and we thank you so much for holding us accountable, our dear listeners.
Yeah, especially when they're, like, nice about it.
Yeah.
All right. So, this one is another personal opinions, no right answer one, but of course, if it's not the same answer as me, you're probably wrong. Mm. This is another Annette prompt. Which magical and quirky Wes Anderson movie home, location, or mode of transportation would you most desire to occupy? I'm going to go with Neil first because I'm afraid he's going to take my answer. So let's just band-aid right off.
Magical
Neil.
Or quirky Wes Anderson movie home, location, or mode of transportation? I mean, it's either a small motorcycle or the lighthouse home from Moonrise Kingdom, which I've always found to be one of the coolest places. Although, I'm not a big fan of, like, the storms, but I'm pretty sure that place has the kind of climate that I would be into, and who wouldn't want to live in that house?
That's, like, the opposite of the... You want to live in, like, the windswept shores of somewhere in New England?
But it seems like it would be, like, 60 at the warmest.
Yeah, why do you live in Austin again?
We don't have enough time for that.
Well, okay, so I you know, I think you'll be safe in your lighthouse home as long as you listen to Bob Balaban's weather reports in Moonrise Kingdom. I am torn between picking the Grand Budapest, the titular locations, which is the Grand Budapest Hotel itself or the Darjeeling Limited train. And I think I would pick the Darjeeling Limited train because, like, I don't know. I've never gone on a really fancy sleeper car train ride. And I think that would be really fun. Or maybe I would get really motion sick. So.
Or it would be a really meticulously laid plan that goes wrong.
Yeah, you know, or Neil, that. I'm really glad that I had you watch that one video that you keep referencing.
Well... You know, it's one of those things where they're right about all these things.
I know. I just feel like such a fool because I rewatched all these movies and then I sent you one video and you're like, well, way more prepared than I am.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I rewatched like hours and hours of movies. You're like, cool. I watched an 8-minute YouTube video.
Right. And I fell asleep like 30 minutes into Fantastic Mr. Fox the other day.
I'm the fool. All right. Dave Gonzalez. What's your answer to this?
Well, it was down to two things, and so I was going to do the one that somebody else didn't pick. You took the train, so not the train, which leaves me, even with my fear of underwater dinosaurs, with Steve Zissou's traveling research boat.
Wow.
Because you got a steam room in the back. So, like, do your research, watch the sunset, go to the steam room, sleep, listen to some sonar, like gently rock you to bed. I'm not going to think too much about taking the submarine down, but maybe that's what my guests can do.
Yeah, I would not ever recommend you go in that thing, given your particular set of fears.
Yep, only if the giant monsters of the sea look stop motion animated would they be okay with me.
Yeah.
That's because they look like that in Steve Zissou. There we go.
All
right.
If all the creatures of the sea looks like they came out of Wes Anderson movies, it'd be so much more fun of a place to be. But they're
exactly.
not. They're terrifying.
Even if I got eaten, I'd be whimsically eaten, and you guys would spend a significant chunk of your life trying to avenge me. So that's positive, I feel.
And we may meet like a long-lost son along the way.
Whimsically eaten, the Dave Gonzalez story.
What happened to Dave? Well, he was whimsically eaten a few years back. Funny story, actually. All right. Speaking of that video Neil watched, Neil, would you like to explain our next prompt?
Yes. So his favorite Wes Anderson parody, spoof, or humorous analysis. Because I think these are three different things, but they're all sort of in the same world. I guess we could choose from, or if you have other ones, the Honest Trailers, which is the video that we keep referencing. The Honest Trailers for every Wes Anderson movie ever, which is hysterical. Normally those videos are very like nitpicky and sort of cynical, but this one sort of embraces like just the weirdness.
It ends on a positive.
It kind of reminds me of there was also one, I think it was an Honest Trailer, where like halfway through they kind of just like stopped and they're like, wait, this movie is good.
I think it was the Dark Knight.
Yes.
So
this one's very similar to that, where it's but it also does break down a lot of the things that are very repetitive about Wes Anderson, that are things he likes to do. And none of that's bad, I think, is the ultimate finding of this video. It's none of it is necessarily bad. It's just all specific. Like, everything about Wes Anderson is specific. And I guess I can see how that would rub people the wrong way. There's also the SNL sketch, what is it? The
Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders.
I almost said charcuterie. the Wes Anderson horror movie. And then there's the Amex commercial that Wes Anderson directed himself. I will always stump for the Amex commercial, because self-referential is the way to go. If you're going to get made fun of, be the person who punches first by punching yourself in the face. So I think that the Amex commercial also was like the first time I remember seeing Wes Anderson talk.
Yeah.
And it's just this delightful. One of the best details of that Amex commercial is how everyone's like eating through the whole thing. Like, he's eating something. His production assistant is eating something. The producer like picks something up off someone's plate randomly and eats it. There's just like a lot of walking and talking and eating. I expected Brad Pitt to show up and eat something. So
wrong director.
Yeah, I know. That's the Soderbergh episode. Anyway, so I'm always going to stump for the Amex commercial, because anytime someone makes fun of themselves, I think that's pretty
cool. Yeah. Neil and I were talking about this a little bit off pod. It's sort of like, you know, someone suggested we watch The Honest Trailer. One of our listeners suggested, and I watched it. I was like, wow, this is amazing. And we should talk about like how easy it is to parody Wes Anderson, because it is super easy. You just need the right font and like some vintage clothing, et cetera, et cetera. I like the SNL sketch. I like the Screen Junkies thing. But like the fact that the Amex commercial exists, it came out in 2004. It's an American Express ad that's like basically, a one shot of Wes Anderson. It was like part of a campaign where like a bunch of different famous people were like, this is how I use my Amex card or whatever. It's Wes Anderson making fun of himself. And so like if he's self-aware enough to be like, yep, this is me. These are all my tropes. I like that. He's done a bunch of other commercials too. There's like an H&M commercial that's really good. A Prada commercial. You know, he's done these like, they're basically like short films. The H&M commercial, I think, is like, it stars Adrian Brody. It takes place on a train and it's like really Christmassy. It's really, really cute. It's basically a short film. And Wes Anderson is super good at making short films. He's like, he and Spike Jones are like premier, obviously, like commercial music video style directors as well as feature film directors. But yeah, I have to go with the Amex commercial as well, because like, you know, if you're going to make fun of yourself, that's aces in my book. So there you go.
Well, I'm going to take the Honest Trailers, because I happened to find it before our listener sent it to us and then had to stop halfway through and stop Java from doing whatever she was doing because it was less important and be like, watch this trailer. Because the way, you know, it sort of stacks on top of itself and points out how the references sort of overlap is really interesting, because at the beginning of that trailer, that my thoughts were how much of this stuff I've internalized, kind of coming of age as a movie watcher in the Wes Anderson era, that I could sort of see it mirrored occasionally, especially how he uses some symmetrical wide shots. Because I think, I don't know if it was an actual movement or just the films that I saw when I was in college trying to figure out stuff about films, but there was always this idea that the main focal points of a 16:9 screen or anything in that aspect ratio are the upper and lower corners, a little bit like out of that sort of area. That's where you want to put faces or objects coming out of people's pockets or things like that. And I think Wes Anderson definitely was the most mainstream person to bring symmetry back. And I don't think he did it single-handedly, but as more people had access to making films, I think more people attempted to do symmetrical shots. You know, the Zach Braffs of the world, I think, were built out of the Wes Andersons. I don't think they started out that way. So, in terms, since this question is favorite Anderson parody and not best, I'm going to go with the honest trailers.
Yeah.
Even though you guys are probably right that an actual work of art by the person is probably better than something making fun of it. But as criticism, it's good criticism. So I'm going to pick it.
It's good. It's really, really good. It might be my favorite one that they did. Like, and I, sorry, the sirens are here for me.
Yeah. That's what you get for agreeing with me.
And it has to compete with the honest trailer for The Happening, which is maybe one of the best things I've ever seen in my entire life. So that used to be my favorite, but this might be my favorite now. So a listener also pointed out, because I think, I mean, that Screen Junkies honest trailer came out like sort of pegged to Isle of Dogs. So it came out recently, like within the last couple weeks. I don't know how recent this thing is, like while we're speaking of Wes Anderson parodies, but there's a subreddit. Maybe it's super old. I just didn't know about it. And a listener mentioned it today. There's a subreddit called Accidental Wes Anderson. and if you click through, it's really funny. And it's just like people posting photos of like this photo from my wedding or like my brother on tour of India. And it's just like things that accidentally look like they could be a still from a Wes Anderson movie. It's really funny. So speaking of easily parodied, it's a pretty solid peruse if you have some time and want to scroll through a subreddit. So
yeah, and I want to bet that everything that's accidentally Wes Anderson is at least baseline well composed. So there's a way to sort of trim stuff down.
It's definitely symmetrical.
Yeah, use those things you learn from watching movies. All right, into fantasy casting. That's Dave reading the notes in real time. Which actor would you most want to see join the Andersonverse? Man, ooh. Okay, the first thing that jumps to my head is probably not great because I don't know if it would be allowed to get like that sort of comedy seriousness that he's really good at, but I'd be interested in seeing what Aubrey Plaza could do in a Wes Anderson movie.
I don't know if Aubrey Plaza is almost like too perfect for, like, she's doing Wes Anderson 24/7. Do you know what I mean? So like the flat affect like might, like, you can't even tell she's doing a flat affect. Do you know what I mean?
Well, but I was like trying to pick somebody that would like immediately fit in, so hopefully they'd be able to plus it, because it's like, we could see, you know, I don't know, John Cryer's monotone voice, but do I want to see that? No, I just want to see. I want to see Aubrey Plaza try something different within a wheelhouse that she practices in all the time.
Oh my God! Like, please always go to Ducky for your primary example for things. I think my answer is sort of on a similar trend, and it gets to something. I'm glad you picked a woman. It gets to something that like we're going to talk about later on in all caps, which is Wes Anderson and women and how well or not well he does them. But I would pick Parker Posey, but only if Parker Posey gets to be like the protagonist of the damn movie. So I don't want no bit part for Parker Posey. I want a Wes Anderson film starring Parker Posey in the main role. That's my, that would be my pick.
That's a good one, and it half steals mine, but not entirely, because Parker Posey is a good call. I want Wes Anderson to do something that he has not done, which is to have a protagonist who is female with also, I mean, she could also have like daddy issues or parental issues, just like all of the men in Wes Anderson's movies. but I would like to, it really has to be somebody with comedic timing, somebody who, the tough part about this question for me was trying to think of someone who hasn't been in a Wes Anderson movie already, who feels like they could be in a Wes Anderson movie. Mm-hmm. And I landed on Letitia Wright because she feels like she has the right comedic timing potential to fit very well in a Wes Anderson movie, but also be her own star, be her own light in the universe, because she's the best. And I think that she should be in everything, as evidence from her performances in Black Panther and Black Mirror. I would like to see her star in a movie or show that isn't Black something. That's,
it could be Black something. You just have to be what, very selective about
Wes
what it
Anderson's
is. Black Stallion.
Black.
Wes Anderson's Black Stallion.
You think actors are hard to control? Fuck you, horses. Make this horse ride on the beach. It doesn't want to. Fuck you, Wes Anderson.
That's a good segue, actually, into our next prompt. This whole thing is a good segue into our next prompt, right?
Yes.
Yes. What book, this is another Annette prompt, what book, TV, or movie franchise would you like to see Wes Anderson tackle next should this middle-aged white man be given his own Marvel or Star Wars project?
I mean, it has to be like Shuri's Home Life, directed by Wes Anderson, movie.
With much love to Annette, I'm just going to break the rules and reject her premise and just say, like, we don't want Wes Anderson to make something like that. We want Wes Anderson to keep like doing Wes Anderson shit, because like we're gonna
wait. That seems like completely rejecting the prompt. Surely there's something you want Wes Anderson to do. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a Marvel or Star Wars project.
How dare you hold me accountable? I'll just steal.
I mean, I already told Neil that he's being disqualified for double choosing things, so I have to disqualify you for something.
I'll just steal the answer from the Screen Junkies Honest trailer, which is the drama club at Hogwarts.
That is a good one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I agree with Joanna's original point, which is, I think that's actually fun. Oddly enough, one of the themes of the video that we've been referencing is like, we don't want to see Wes Anderson do like a CGI heavy, crazy thing. And also, I can't think of an existing sort of world that feels like it fits. I'm sure there are plenty, but I would almost want to go like completely ridiculous and be like, Wes Anderson directs a Super Mario Brothers movie or something just stupid. Or we just let everyone try Ghostbusters. Like everyone gets to do a Ghostbusters movie.
Everyone try Ghostbusters.
So the next one is Wes Anderson's Ghostbusters.
Well, yeah, I'd watch like a Grindhouse version of Ghostbusters where it's like 5 mini movies in 3 hours, but different people doing Ghostbusters.
The thing about Wes Anderson is like, we're going to get to some critiques of Wes Anderson, but like he is one of a very small, and that's kind of the problem too, because they're all white dudes, but he's one of a very small club of directors in Hollywood who can sort of like get anything they want made by their own very distinct vision. You know, your Tarantinos, your Spielbergs, your Wes Andersons. And I would say there are about like 10.
Christopher Nolan.
Oh yeah, Nolan, definitely. And that's almost impossible to do nowadays in Hollywood, to do like like a non-IP sort of thing. And so like I don't need Wes Anderson playing in the pool of IP, because he's one of the only filmmakers who can get like a budget to do something that's not IP. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
Okay. Let me throw some things at the wall and see what sticks, because I think there's a way around this question. All right. sticking with Neil, who put Dan Aykroyd in my mind, what if Wes Anderson remade Blues Brothers?
Oh, my God.
All right, I got one. Joanna, still no?
Still no.
Wow. Okay, I mean, you want him to do something original close. And play. You want him to do something original and play to his strengths. So, what about you give him a Lego movie?
No.
I mean, there are a lot of objects of which you can do overhead shots in Lego,
and the plot can be about anything. There's no plot to a Lego movie. It could be about whatever it is, as long as it's about building. In the end of the day,
Wes Anderson's Superman.
No.
That's what the DCEU really needs, is Wes Anderson.
just all of the DCEU. Just yeah. Five films, the exact Zack Snyder films, just remade by Wes Anderson.
Green Lantern. But he's constantly creating, like compasses and small hammers with his power ring.
Small hammers.
I'm gonna channel David Ehrlich and say you guys are all morally bankrupt human beings and you should feel bad about it.
Listen, we're just trying to support the commercialistic thirsts of the masses here with Wes Anderson.
They have plenty to slake their thirst.
Well, and it's interesting because I think that, and we'll probably talk about this in the last segment when we get to Isle of Dogs, which is, I think Wes Anderson operates from a position of curiosity and wanting to explore things that he's specifically interested in, which I think probably leads us into the next question as well. I don't see Wes Anderson as a guy who's like specifically interested in like comic book movies, or not to say that he couldn't be, but it just doesn't feel like it fits.
Give him the Christopher Robin 2.
Still Robin. Because you know that. Season.
I think Robin season. Perfect.
I think the Paddington franchise is the closest we're going to get to like a Wes Anderson-ish franchise.
It is Andersonian. That's true.
Yep.
All right.
Oh, maybe they're just giving Paddington 3. All right. But the answer apparently is no answer.
Or it can be whatever you guys said. It's
the
fine.
Answer is a rejection of the premise.
I'm just trying to move us along. I'm going to do, because I wrote us too many prompts, as our token female in the podcast, just like the token females of a Wes Anderson film, I'm going to read this last email before we get to Isle of Dogs. This comes from Carol Ma, who wrote our Wes Anderson no email. Okay. She wrote, Wes Anderson, probably by his own admission, may not be able to write women well. And she links to a Refinery 29 article where, you know, Wes Anderson basically talked about how he writes things from his like very own specific perspective. I've never skipped or fast forward through any of your episodes. You are my favorite podcast. Still, I'll be gritting my teeth through this one. Ask yourself, as a movie going, we're watching the umpteenth preview for Isle of Dogs, if there are any compelling female characters. Those dogs are all male. There's one small part for a female human in that trailer. Much later on Reddit, I saw two character posters for Tilda Swinton and Scarlett Johansson characters, but the sexist folks who made the trailer act like there are virtually no female characters. Really? A whole island of canines and they're all male? Why? Make the case that it's worth my while, because it just seems like it's not. This is a good way, I think, for us to like sort of transition into Isle of Dogs, but talking about his broader filmography and the fact that I don't think he's ever written a convincing female character, and I think that that's true. As Dave alluded to before, Wes Anderson is fascinated in the sad male psyche.
We don't count Margot Tenenbaum.
I don't count Margot Tenenbaum. No, okay. I mean I like Margot Tenenbaum as a character. I like a lot of these women characters. They just don't seem like convincing female characters to me. Carol's point about the Isle of Dogs, like Tilda Swinton is like super barely in this movie, so don't get your hopes up. Scarlett Johansson, I think, is a slightly problematic character in this movie, and Greta Gerwig is the most problematic character in Isle of Dogs. So, also Frances McDormand. Anyway, like the use of women in Isle of Dogs, it's not concerned with women, and none of his movies really seem to be very concerned with women. I think he tried to argue that the young girl in Moonrise, Wes Anderson tried to argue that the young girl in Moonrise Kingdom was the real protagonist of the movie. I reject that explanation of Moonrise Kingdom. But here's the thing about Wes Anderson, and this is something I was discussing with some other friends recently, which is like he is telling his story. The reason Wes Anderson's so easy to parody is he's just telling his story fractured over different media, different time periods, different whatever. And it's of like sad male psyche, family dysfunction, love and loss, ennui, all of this sort of stuff. And it works,
small,
I think.
Small groups of men running around in trash.
It works, I think, because it's like, it's true. It's authentic and true to how Wes Anderson feels. No matter like how much pretentious ephemera he might put around it, like there is a truth to the sad male character psyche that he is exploring. Now, those people out there in the world who are like, cool, I'm a little done with the sad white straight male psyche character, like I don't want to see it anymore, I'm not going to push back too hard on that, but I'm just going to say, like, my preference whenever we talk about this is not like to tell Wes Anderson to shut up with his specific point of view, but to hopefully make more room for people like a Greta Gerwig or a Jordan Peele who are telling their perspective. Like, I just want all perspectives, but that or Barry Jenkins, like that deep personal perspective of a Get Out, of a Lady Bird, of a Moonlight are the films that I've reacted to the most in the last few years. And I don't want to tell Wes Anderson to stop because I want what he does, but I will not be able to defend his ability to write women because I don't think he can. It might be like he collaborates with Owen Wilson, Jason Schwartzman, Roman Coppola. I don't know that he's ever collaborated with a woman to write a film. I don't know if that's true. I'd be interested to see what he does because I have a similar criticism of Edgar Wright. I don't think Edgar Wright can write women either. But I think Spaced, which was co-written with a woman, Jessica Hines, does have the most well-rounded perspective. So like if Wes Anderson wanted to team up with a woman to write a story, I think that might be very interesting. Anyway, that's my answer to Carol and my woman rant.
I think that's an excellent point. My question, when stuff like that always comes up is like, what's the real problem here? The real problem here isn't that Wes Anderson, the larger problem isn't that Wes Anderson won't change or do something different outside of his comfort zone. The problem is that there aren't enough equivalents to Wes Anderson that come from different backgrounds. You know, that there aren't women directors who are like Wes Anderson, or not in like a specific like pastiche way, but like just sort of in a general way of being able, like you mentioned before, where it's like they could just kind of get their stuff made and they're sort of widely appreciated as a filmmaker. So, and that's interesting because it is funny. Somebody tweeted, actually April Wolf, who's a fantastic film critic, tweeted something about Wes Anderson. I forget specifically what it was like, do you think Wes Anderson cares that like, you know, certain groups of people are out there stumping for his films, you know, to say that like, oh, there's like, you know, let's say a group of problematic people like Wes Anderson films. I don't know if Wes Anderson thinks about that. He's just out there trying to do his thing. And I've always read his thing as being sort of an earnest representation of what he wants to say. And I don't know if we can totally fault him for that. It's more of an industry problem that we're not making room for other voices. It's not necessarily Wes Anderson's fault.
Yeah, I would say the only thing that I would have to add to what either of you said was that the main frustration I think the Neil sort of hit upon is that Wes Anderson doesn't change. He's not a reactive filmmaker. It feels like every movie he makes is another layer of the Wes Anderson onion. It's not, oh, I learned this from this and now I'm going to pivot and this has changed my worldview. So if there's any frustration, like I like his movies, the sad male narrative speaks to me. Same reason I liked Animalisa, even though everybody else who I saw it with hated it. But the frustrating thing is it feels like we as his audience have been saying this sort of thing for a while, and Isle of Dogs doesn't look like he's reacted to any of that at all. And that's really frustrating just as somebody who wants to like his work, but also acknowledges this problem. It's like he can acknowledge the problem, like in the Refinery 29 article, but if it's not spurring change, then something's not connecting inside the Wes Anderson brain.
Yeah. And I think even then you run into the, sort of problems with with an audience telling a filmmaker what they should be doing versus right. the filmmaker making what they want to make and letting the audience sort of digest it the way, however they want to do, you know, once the movie's out there, you can take it however you want. I would probably say that Wes Anderson is one of those filmmakers who is less concerned with what the audience thinks and more concerned with making what he wants. You know, like
that makes him more
all the time where it's like, you know, Star Wars fans didn't like X, Y, and Z because that's not what they think it should be. I think the same can apply here.
I think there are some differences, like we're going to get into it with Isle of Dogs. Like I would not suggest that Wes Anderson, like, not make the stories that he wants to make. But if, a reasoned, reasonable argument services of like, hey, the way you treated XYZ demographic in your movie was frustrating to me for this reason, I would like it if filmmakers would listen to that, because maybe it's just a perspective that they hadn't considered. And that doesn't mean like you need to like make an Asian person like the protagonist of your next film or something like that. Though why not? But like, it does mean that like, I think we can all always listen and learn. I do think there's a distinction between like, hey, did you consider this? And like, hey, you need to make exactly the movie I want you to make. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always think back to how Scott Derrickson was trapped in Doctor Strange and he just kept tweeting like, I'm listening, but like nothing changed and everybody got mad. But the reality is he worked for Marvel and that was always going to be what that was. Like, is that what we want from people? I'm genuinely asking because that seems close.
I mean, it's close, but it's like, I think Marvel learned something from that. Like, I mean, it's hard to pick out individual filmmakers in the Marvel universe. You know what I mean? But like, I think Marvel would never do the same thing they did with Tilda Swinton and Doctor Strange after what happened, probably out of like a more shallow thing of like wanting to avoid negative backlash. But still, that's a lesson learned by the film industry of like, hey, when you do this, it makes us feel this way about your film. Doctor Strange is still enormously successful at the box office, though. So like, you know, people didn't necessarily vote with their dollars on that one. But now Marvel's here to arrest me.
you gotta just be real careful about what you say.
I guess
I don't know. We're a little bit in the weeds and like talking around maybe like the bigger specific controversy of Isle of Dogs, which is maybe something we should get into. I don't know.
Yeah, let's jump to the problematic. Neil, you want to pick this one up since you haven't read a thing today?
Yes, let me read this this email from Brushy Sunshine, who always writes us very poetic emails. I assume this is one of them. I haven't read it yet, but we're about to share it together. Maybe it's troubling to me because it's so beautiful and amazing to look at. It's a poison pill wrapped in the most fussy, beautiful amuse-bouche you can find. And I think an artist can create anything they want. I feel they can take from cultures and explore them and discuss them, and art belongs to all of us. But at the same time, you have to ask, if you're taking from another culture, why are you doing it? What are you saying? What does it mean to have a history of Orientalism or otherness? Are you questioning that? Are you aware? And in the end, art can provoke art, can be unpleasant. I don't understand that sentence. Anyway, when I worked at the Guggenheim, we were told never to give refunds if people hated the art we showed, because having an angry reaction is a reaction, and entertainment is about a good time, and art is about making you see the world differently than before. Sorry, reading comprehension is not my thing this afternoon.
I think you've got it all right.
Yeah.
I think you're just missing some commas. Yeah.
So if nothing else with this film, Wes Anderson has got under my skin and really made my brain itch. Mixed analogies, sorry. Anyway, can't wait to hear y'all's thoughts and feelings, and I can't go see Ready Player One because, you know, the way it just holds up nostalgia as this great thing, the book did at least, you know, nostalgia is considered a disease by the Victorians. We're at pandemic levels with it now.
I had a choice. Okay,
let me
just say, Brushy wrote us this like really long email, and this is just like one paragraph pulled out of it. And like, and she acknowledged in the email that like, I think she signed it like Mother of Dragon and on and on and on. Like, acknowledged that it was a super long email. It's too long. This was like the best graph I could pull out to sort of like get to sort of the heart of what she was talking about. And I left in that thing about Ready Player One because I just like her tangents sometimes. But so, I mean, like, obviously there's been like some controversy around Isle of Dogs, which is Wes Anderson's latest film that is in some but not all theaters right now, which is set in a fictional city of Megasaki, Japan, where due to a outbreak of disease, the dog population has been exiled to Trash Island. And it's the story of, you know, the people who want to protect these dogs, a group of dogs themselves, and very specifically one boy who goes to the island to try to find his lost dog. And the question from the people... maybe this is the wrong term to use, but people kind of had their knives up for this movie from like the very first trailer. And my memory of that very first trailer, and I regret that I did not go back and rewatch it, is that it just lists the white actors, in this role, in this, film, and doesn't really mention the Japanese actors. And later publicity had like an inclusion of all the Japanese voices that are used in the film, including Yoko Ono as a character called Yoko Ono. But for the most part, it seemed like a movie set in Japan for like an arbitrary reason, featuring the voice talents of the likes of Jeff Goldblum, Edward Norton, Brian Cranston, and Liev Schreiber, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and then, so like, so hackles were raised from the jump. And then when the movie came out, in sort of wide release, some critics, and very specifically some Asian and Asian American critics, sort of tried to explain what they had a problem with in terms of the way in which the Japanese culture and the Japanese people are used in this movie. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that Wes Anderson made a choice in this movie to, there's a title card at the beginning that says like, all the barks have been translated to English. None of the Japanese has been translated except for like, in, you know, there's like a translator played by Fran McDormand. There's like a few like captions, but there's no subtitles to the Japanese language. And this, I think more than anything else, rubbed some people the wrong way because it, I think one person put it that it like made the Japanese characters feel like foreigners in their own setting, which I thought was interesting. Anyway, one of the biggest pieces on this, I think one of the best and most balanced pieces on this, though there's great ones from Karen Hahn, Angie Hahn, a bunch of different writers, but Justin Chang wrote a piece for the LA Times called Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs is often captivated, but cultural sensitivity gets lost in translation. There was a huge like backlash to Justin's article, which was like, I think, written by people who didn't read his article, because he spends like 2/3 of the article talking about what he likes about Wes Anderson, what he likes about this movie. And then he's like, here's the third where I talk about where I think he missed the mark. And I really recommend that as a read because I think it's very balanced and very fair. I think some of the knee-jerk reaction to the movie is not really fair, but, you know, living as an Asian or an Asian American is not my experience either. So I don't know. So sorry that was like maybe Brushy Sunshine email link context, but I want to start with Dave, who just saw the movie yesterday, and then I'm going to roll to Neil. But Dave, like, you went, I don't want to throw your lovely girlfriend under the bus, but like, you and Java are usually very sensitive to cultural appropriation, cultural tourism, cultural misappropriation, and you guys sort of like went into the movie bracing yourselves and walked out being like, no, this wasn't as bad as I was bracing myself for. So I was just wondering if you could talk about like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it reads as a mistake of not knowing when you're telling a joke and when you're othering people. The translation, it is a perfect example where it does make your relationship to certain characters more distant because they're never going to speak your language literally, and that you have to sort of be fed these sort of things. The really, I think, egregious stuff for me was there's a poison called wasabi poison that doesn't need to be wasabi for any reason.
Yeah.
And they make fun of haikus for no reason. those are the two things that I was really like, but what really like struck me the most is that I'm not going to have a actual violent reaction to this because I'm not Asian American and I didn't grow up with any Asian cultural traditions. So the world building is so specific. He builds basically another culture to somebody like me. Like there's context clues into the movie, in the movie, why the certain things that he's fetishized from Asian culture are in that particular story, but it just as easily could have been anthropomorphized animals or a bunch of lamps versus a bunch of desk lamps. Like there's nothing in it specifically that has to tie it to the Japanese culture. That sort of seems like a fetishistic overlay. So I don't think that's great. But again, because it's not my culture, I could only problematize it so much. And it, for me, it fell within the realm of just Wes Anderson is tone deaf. So I'm not any more mad at Isle of Dogs for what it does with Asians as I am for Isle of Dogs for what it does with its female characters. And ultimately, both of those things are things that I'm usually mad at to a certain extent in Wes Anderson movies, even as far back in as Bottle Rocket as some of its assumptions it makes about its Hispanic characters.
Yeah. Bottle Rocket is like one of the worst, to be honest.
So like that stuff's always existed for me. I don't feel like Isle of Dogs went above and beyond. Like there's weird tone-deaf stuff like what Yoko Ono's character actually stands for, and she's named Yoko Ono, which is sort of like this assistant to a greater man who dies, and then she decides not to carry on his legacy until the white exchange student talks her into it. So like that just seems like layers and layers were compounded to become something problematic. For example, as Joanna was saying, there's a title card that says all the dogs barks and growls have been translated into English. What that means is that eventually when you see a puppy, the puppy makes baby sounds. It seems like that was the joke that was the beginning of the whole thing about the dog speaking English and everybody else speaks. They don't say everything else is left to Japanese. They say everything else is left in its native like speaker unless it's left translated. So it's like they built up to this joke that the puppies were going to sound like babies. And by doing it, you have your American audience just completely tune out of certain character arcs because all the characters are doing are speaking in Japanese or speaking very simplified Japanese so that we make sure to know what they're talking about. And that's racist and it's bad, but it's not maliciously bad. So it's hard for me to get angry at that tone deafness, not from the position of the group that's being assaulted.
Yeah, and I want to hear what Neil has to say about this, but I do want to quickly provide one more piece of context, which I didn't provide, which and I really like everything that you said, Dave, which is that this is not new for Wes Anderson, right? Like you mentioned Bottle Rocket, but there's also like the Darjeeling Limited is basically like three shitty white guys like go to find themselves in India, right? They cast Irfan Khan, who's one of the best, considered one of the best actors in the whole world, and he has like no lines. And, you know, so like that is cultural tourism, the movie. Like Wes Anderson is enchanted by the visuals without really engaging in any of the people of that culture. That being said, that's kind of the point of that movie is like you're kind of supposed to think of these as like three shitty white guys trying to find themselves in India. Similarly in Royal Tenenbaums, like that's my favorite example is like the character of Pagoda, who is treated like trash by Gene Hackman's character Royal. There's often a brown subservient as the Screen Junkies honest trailer thing pointed out. There's usually a brown subservient like love interest or sidekick, and it's not new for Wes Anderson to sort of treat people in turbans or otherwise that way, and so I could see why this might be like a boiling point for some people when we get to Isle of Dogs. Neil, as our resident straight white dude.
Just normal ass white guy.
what
Well, it's interesting.
Whip hand and eel lit from below, not saying anything.
I'm just going to throw a cat out the window and run away. I think I compartmentalize Wes Anderson movies because there's two sides of this. One is I am kind of a shitty white dude, so I find these movies delightful. And like his
story. One said shitty. No one said shitty about you.
No, I'm saying that about me.
All right.
But you know, some of the stories that he tells are sort of right there in my wheelhouse. But then there's also this idea of like, and I think I was reading a piece by Karen Hahn, who is an excellent writer. She wrote a piece on the Daily Beast about how it is sort of shallow cultural tourism. And I think that's really spot on. I have always interpreted Wes Anderson's, every time he sort of dives into a different culture, as curiosity, but not immersion. So it's like Wes Anderson loves Japanese culture. I can tell from Isle of Dogs that he wanted to make a little samurai story for himself, but he's not immersed. He doesn't immerse himself enough to get some of that stuff right. So it really does feel like tourism. He really does feel like the couple from Wisconsin who are walking around with their book, trying, you know, their little translation book, trying to navigate their way around China, which is a specific experience. And when it is translated by Anderson into a film like this, I can totally see how it would rub people the wrong way if they are immersed in that culture. I would say that, you know, it's so that includes people from Japan, Japanese Americans, people who study Japanese culture probably find plenty to be upset about. But here's the other thing, and I don't think I would ever go to bat for Wes Anderson as some sort of like good person, I guess. But I have always read that as more of an earnest desire to explore these cultures rather than some sort of malicious. Like, you watch Isle of Dogs, and there's probably the reason why it's easier for someone like me to be okay with it is that it doesn't feel like it has a malicious bone in its body. Like, it's not trying to mess people up. It's just, it does some dumb stuff. Otherwise, it's a very delightful, extremely well-crafted, very Wes Anderson-y movie. So I think that you have to I compartmentalize it into two things. There's my experience with the film, which is as just me. And then there is me listening to other people's experiences with the film, which I think is just as important if you want to be someone who engages with art on another level. So I think that, I don't know, it's possible that if anyone's wrong, it's probably me, because that's usually how it goes. but I don't know if anybody's wrong. Like, you know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
I think the only people who are wrong are, A, the people who are saying that, like, the Asian and Asian American writers, like, don't have a right or a wrong to express their point of view. And
oh,
no,
the kid in this movie is named Atari. They totally have
plenty
of room to
Kobayashi. Yeah. The other people I think are wrong are the people who, like, just from the trailer were like, I'm out. I mean, it's fine if you're like kind of to yourself, not for me. But if you're like,
right,
it stands for. Like,
I think know enough about Wes Anderson to know if you're sort of in or out in general on Wes Anderson at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think if you watch the trailer and you're like, this is racist without having actually seen the film, I don't know. I'm not going to like argue with you, but I think it's just better to see the thing. You know, well, I say that having like not seen Ghost in the Shell and been like, no, I don't think so.
I saw Ghost in the Shell. It's, also, it's fucking weird.
Ghost in the Shell is not a Joanna movie.
No, it's true.
You wouldn't have seen Ghost in the Shell if they cast an Asian Jed.
I would have if it had been like really, if it had been really good, I would have seen it. Yeah.
But I do think
it had to be really good and cast an Asian lead.
Yeah,
I do think that there is sort of value in what came out of Brushy Sunshine's email here, the little anecdote about the Guggenheim, where it's like, we don't give refunds. Art is there, you know, the artist makes the art, you get to interpret the art however you want to interpret the art, and you get to feel however you want to feel about it. but you can't go back and like change it. So I think people have a right to be, absolutely have a right to be mad at Wes Anderson. Other people have a right to enjoy this movie and maybe not see the problems as a problem. But I think we should all listen to each other and accept that that's how art works. That you all kind of get to have your own experience. And as long as you're respectful of everyone else's experience, there's not necessarily anything wrong with it. Although, like we discussed in the last segment, maybe the problem with Wes Anderson is ultimately that he isn't reactionary. Like, he is just going to make his shit forever. And
I think that's a plus.
That may knock him down a peg in your mind, or it may be fine with you.
I think it's a plus and a minus, yes. Honestly.
Right, because there are people like the aforementioned David Ehrlich, who love them some Wes Anderson, will ride or die for Wes Anderson.
David Ehrlich is also, by his own admission, a white dude who loves Japan. So, you know, it's like this movie was
which is made. he married into the native blood. So,
okay, great. I dare you to use the phrase native blood when talking to David Ehrlich and his lovely bride.
I would ingest, and they would get it because they get me.
Oh, okay, all right.
Can I say some non-Asian things about Isle of Dogs?
Of course, especially like from an animation standpoint. I'm curious what you think, Dave.
Yeah, so he's really stepped forward in making stop motion look good. The way that they use both wind and I think some digital smoothing to make the noise that you would get in animating basically be completely justified in whatever actual settings happening is amazing. I'm assuming they're using 3D printer face replacement technology to animate all the human characters because there aren't any seams and they all are very well textured when they aren't being rendered in 2D animation. So animation wise, I really dig it. Storytelling wise, I kind of wish that Wes Anderson knew or that Wes Anderson was willing to let the audience know that the story was primarily about the dogs further forward in the movie. I feel like we spend 20 minutes trying to get our footing, so much so that when we do actually click into the dog storyline, we have to jump back and do a whole bunch of flashbacks to see how we got there. I feel like we don't need it, the human storyline, really at all, and which kind of makes our whole conversation about it being problematic even more painful because it could have been jettisoned and, like I said earlier, replaced with anything. But once you do get to like the story of the dogs, I just think it's told out of order in comparison to the greater government conspiracy human story. Like everything that's the dogs, I like in terms of building story. Tilda Swinton's character, especially, and how she gets to be the Oracle and know things before the other dogs. But I feel like because of all the jumping and flashbacking to try to make these emotional points, what you're left with is like 20 minutes of climax where everybody's crying, which they've figured out how to make look cool in stop motion now, but it's everything kind of slammed together to make like this false climax about a boy samurai that doesn't pay off. So a little shaggy on the storytelling, but really great on the visuals is how I'd Isle of Dogs zero sum it, assuming that race isn't an issue for you.
Yeah, I will say this. Every time either a human or a dog character's eyes filled up with tears, it worked on me. all of that shit worked on me. One of the, you know, to go back to one of our earlier prompts about like which actor would you like to see join the Andersonverse, like who this film adds to that, you know, roster that Anderson likes to pull from. We get Bryan Cranston sort of for the first time as our lead dog, and he's very good. Greta Gerwig seems like, I can't believe she hasn't already been in a Wes Anderson film, right? Even though I think her character is probably one of the biggest problems of the movie. And I guess Liev Schreiber is a really good voice casting, but I'll leave you to figure out why. And Scarlett Johansson, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, of all of those, Bryan Cranston, I'm excited.
Scarlett Johansson, I guess.
I love Scarlett Johansson, but I don't, that character is kind of trash to me. Of all the additions.
The dog's kind of attractive. I was switching to Java.
She plays the
I was switching to Java the other day. Well, it's like Disney cracked how to make canines attractive in Robin Hood. And ever since then, if you hew to that model of orange with the big white eyes, it works. Hence why you never want to search Zootopia without safe search on. And why Scarlett Johansson's dog is attractive. Sorry, go ahead, Joanna.
No, that's all fine. But one of the prompts that we didn't get to was like, who is your favorite, like, I don't know, actor who had been added ever to the Wes Anderson verse, I guess. I don't know. It was just a long way of me wanting to say earlier in the episode that I think Edward Norton was like born to be a Wes Anderson actor. I love him most in these movies, and I love him so much in I Love Dogs. I think he's so great as, like, I would say second lead dog in the film. And Goldblum's great, Bob Balaban's great, Bill Murray's fine. The less Bill Murray, the better for me these days. I don't know why. Anyway, I like, there is a lot to love about I Love Dogs. When my friends and I left seeing it, because we couldn't find the Isle of Dogs soundtrack on Spotify, as I was like driving us around for multiple hours that night, I just put on like a Tycho Drums station on Spotify. We were just listening to Tycho Drums. By the way, if you're ever driving around at night, Tycho Drums is like makes everything seem like really suspenseful and dramatic. And there's a lot to really, really like about this movie. I don't want to get like lost in the controversy, even though obviously like we spent a lot of time talking about it. Neil, what are some of your like non-controversial takeaways from I Love Dogs?
I mean, like all Wes Anderson movies, I still like Fantastic Mr. Fox better, but I think Dave's right about the animation. There is they've really refined it. I love the way it is shot, and it's shot by Tristan Oliver, who did Paranorman, so does a lot of like Leica work, but also did Fantastic Mr. Fox and I Love Dogs. Great stuff. I thought the score and the soundtrack are great. Shouts to Jeff Goldblum, who makes everything better, even though all of his characters in all the Wes Anderson movies are the most Jeff Goldblum thing possible. So it's always the most random dude. So, like in this movie, he's the dog who just knows gossip randomly.
It's so great.
He loves gossip.
And then I love the Harvey Keitel. Harvey Keitel does show up in this movie.
Yes, it's so good.
It's really funny. So I think, you know, it's a lot of, and I don't know. You don't have to necessarily divorce yourself of the cultural issues to still enjoy this movie. They're there, they exist, but in the moment, this movie is really fun and delightful, and I like the story of the dogs. It's funny because Wes Anderson does these things and to draw your attention to specific elements of the story, and it does make other characters fade out, but the parts that he draws your eyes to, I like. So there's that.
Isle of Dogs. Oh, no, go ahead. If you got more Isle of Dogs, hit it up.
No, I can be done. I mean, like, if someone asked me if they should see it, I would recommend seeing it, especially if you think stop motion is interesting. And I just want to give one more plug to Justin Chang's piece in the LA Times, just because, like, I do think it really gets to what's great about this movie, too, as well as some of the critiques. And I like balanced perspective, and I think that's what Justin brings. That's what we try to bring to this. If you like this movie, great. If you'd rather not, that's fine too. Like, whatever.
I think that's a lot of, there is a lot of value in art that is causes discussion.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, obviously there's literal monetary value for those of us who create content around art. But there's just, I think there, you know, there's a lot of really good, interesting perspectives on this movie that are out there that you can read. And you should.
It's still below the usual suspects bar, which is my bar for a thing that I never have to revisit again because of things I've learned about people who made it. I saw that movie once. I enjoyed it for several years. Then I learned things about it that make me never want to watch it again.
Someday we'll have to just do the problematic episode and we'll just go through them.
Here we go, guys. K-Pax, let's do it.
24-hour marathon, podcast marathon.
If there's a good enough charity and enough people, why not expose ourselves
to
more?
Yeah, I honestly think, and Joanna's right, if you have an interest in stop motion or you've liked Wes Anderson's work previously, see this. You could walk away with some sort of extreme reaction, but that's the risk we take when we step into the ring with a movie.
But also I would suggest, like, if you want to be part of the discussion of, like, is this problematic or is this not, or is this cultural tourism or is it not, like, see it so that you have, like, an informed opinion. I think that's interesting, too. And, you know, so do that. See it. That's what I would say. Either way, I would recommend seeing it. If you don't want to see it, I'm not here to force you. One last addressing of a listener question is someone on Twitter as a cat lover, and we all know that I'm like the cat person on this podcast. Neil is the dog person on this podcast, and
for
Dave
sure.
hates all creatures, great and small. But like, you know,
what? No, I only hate creatures that don't have round pupils. Cats and goats can go fuck the fuck right off.
So, as the resident cat advocate, someone asked us, like,
this movie's very anti-cat, by the way.
No, I want to clarify. Someone was like, do cats come off really poorly in this movie? I say no. Cat owners, yes.
Yeah,
cats
it's themselves, very anti-cat people.
Yeah, it's anti-cat people, not cats themselves. As a cat person, I wasn't troubled by it. So there you go.
Well, that's a lot of controversy. Good thing next week we have something really, really simple.
Right down
right,
the
Neil?
Middle next week. Yes, so next week we are going to be doing the great Spielberg debate, which I'm sure won't be heated in any way. Actually, I feel like we're all going to agree as to what Spielberg's best film is. It'll be the other questions we're going to ask during this debate. I think that this is going to be very similar to what we did this week with Wes Anderson, where we would love to hear prompts from you guys that you would like to know about Spielberg. We are obviously going to be talking about Ready Player One, which one of us has seen so far, but that will change by the time we get to next week. Because I know I'm going to see it. But we also, you know, Spielberg's got a long history that comprises much of our collective childhood. So there's plenty to talk about. I don't imagine this will be the last Spielberg episode we do, so we don't have to get to everything. But it'll be fun to talk about his work and how we got to the Oasis.
Empire of the Sun cast. Yeah.
All right. So until next week's Spielberg debate, where could people find more of your work around the internet? Miss Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com or you can follow me on Twitter at come on, let's shag ass.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
You find me over at filmschoolrejects.com. Follow me at rejects, where I'm tweeting more exclusively about movies. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm of Spoilers and send us your prompts, questions, thoughts, concerns, hashtag problematic views about Steven Spielberg and his, how do you say the word?
Oeuvre.
At stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, where I pin my writing and complain about things in the mornings. Until next week, where it will be chock full of Easter eggs, I'm sure. Here's one for you, Storm of Spoilers listeners. Keep not falling down.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.